Welcome to Language of God. I'm your host, Jim Stump. On this podcast, we've aimed to cover a broad set of topics related to science and faith, evolution and the Bible, and climate change and race, vaccines, artificial intelligence, and prayer. So some of you might scratch your heads a little bit in seeing that our guest for this episode, which was produced live in front of an audience at our big national conference in San Diego, is an artist? But if you know anything about Makoto Fujimura, you know that he speaks with wisdom and insight on a broad spectrum of topics, including, as you'll hear shortly, science. And particularly as one of the themes we've covered many times on the podcast is being human, we thought there could be a really interesting connection between science and art and faith as we consider God as creator and ourselves as image bearers who also create. Makoto Fujimura is a leading contemporary artist. His work has been featured in galleries and museums around the world. He's also an advocate for the arts and for culture care through the International Arts Movement and the Fujimura Institute. He's written several books, including Silence and Beauty, about one of my favorite novels of all time. And his most recent book is Art and Faith, which forms the basis of our conversation here today. Let's get to the conversation. Audience, please join me in welcoming Makoto Fujimura to the podcast.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thanks for doing this, Mako. I think it will be fun. We'll talk about some of these connections between art and science in a bit. But as I do with all of our podcast guests, I want to start with getting to know you a little bit more as a person. You are not just your art, nor an abstract collection of ideas and thoughts, but you're flesh and blood. You have a history. You're connected to places. And of course, these influence you. So if you would, start with a little autobiography. Where do you come from? What were you like as a kid? Who were the people that were important to you in your life?
Thank you, Jim, and thank you for welcoming me in this live conference, live recording. It is great to be here. And I was born in Boston, I was born because my father, who was a leading research scientist in acoustics and phonetics, was doing his postdoc work with Noam Chomsky at MIT. Mm-hmm. And so he brought generative grammar theory back into Japan. I spent considerable amount of time in Japan. Prior to that, I was in Sweden, in Stockholm for a couple of years, and then went to Japanese kindergarten and grade school. And after that, I returned to U.S., where my father did his main research at Bell Labs in Murray Hill. And I was raised in this context of science and innovation. And I became an artist.
How did that happen exactly? Well, when did you first think, I think I'd like to be an artist?
So I went into my undergraduate years at Bucknell University thinking that I would also try to make it in some sort of sciences. I started with ecology and animal behavior, and ended up on my first year actually thinking that I cannot do without my art. It wasn't that I took that for granted, but I didn't really think that, you know, my time spent on all these other activities would displace what I loved the most, which was my studio work. And my mother was an educator, so I always had a place to create at home. So at the end of my first year, I decided to major in art, but I had enough credit in sciences, so I ended up with a double degree.
So, sorry, I keep pushing you even further back here, and maybe there's no interesting story here, but I'm going to keep trying. So as a little kid, are you like making doodles that mom and dad hang up on the refrigerator?
Absolutely.
What do you remember of art as this creative outlet for what you were thinking?
Yeah, my mother kept a painting that I did when I was 2.5 in Sweden. And and framed it and gave it to me as a graduation gift from Bucknell, because I had told her that I'm going to try to make it as an artist. And that was her answer. She gave me this painting, and as if to say that I saw your gift early on, and I've done my best to steward that gift, and you should have this. And I have it in my living room as I go out of my house into the studio every day. I look at it and I say, well, that's my goal today, because it is such a joy-filled painting. It has no ego. There's no excess either, even though it is very gratuitous, and and lines, you know, and colors that I use today. So my aesthetic was formed very early, and that painting proves to me that at the intuitive core of my being are these movements, gestures, colors that which my mother also enjoyed seeing. And my father, a scientist, who when I told him I'm going to try to make it as an artist, he said, oh, great, because that's what I wanted to become. So there you go, two parents, perhaps unusual for Asian family to have this testimony of an artist saying it was my parents who, you know, who allowed me or maybe encouraged me even to pursue the arts.
Well, break another stereotype for us here now, too, because Japan is not often known as a hotbed for Christianity, right? How did your Christian faith come about?
Right. And I was in graduate school back in Japan studying this traditional Japanese craft of Nihonga, which harkens back to 15th century. I was very fortunate as an American student receive a governmental scholarship to study 16th century, 17th century Japanese art form and apply that to my contemporary work, and placed in this lineage program where you study under masters. I was there for 6.5 years, but it was during that time that I came to faith, explicit faith in becoming a follower of Christ. And I call my journey of faith that point as inversion rather than conversion, because what happened was the painting, you know, my mother kept at two. I probably couldn't have articulated or remember that, but whenever I painted, whenever I made anything, I felt a surge coming through me. And I knew that was a gift. It wasn't mine, but it was mine to steward. And as I was more cognizant of what you need to do to keep that side of you alive, then I began to wrestle with this reality of this gift of expression, gift of the arts, with my lack of understanding of how that fit into modernity and postmodernity. And I wrestled with it seriously philosophically for a long time, and not being able to find that there was even a proper place to ask that question in modern understanding of you know, modern anthropology of, you know, or epistemology. So I searched for answer, and I was reading in Japan a poem by William Blake in a cold day in 1987. I remember that moment when it hit me that experience, this visceral experience that I was finding in the studio, connected directly to the voice of Christ. And it was through Blake's poem, of course, the way he phrased that act of sacrifice that Christ gave for our sakes, but also this interaction, that establishment of a relationship that is given by sacrifice for us, for me, And that began a whole slew of unraveling of my own understanding of epistemological questioning that I have done for a decade at that point, and yet it inverted everything I had known about asking that question. Hmm. So at that point, I had actually remember making a commitment that if this is true, if this love is there at the base of the universe, I need to find this. And so I read through the Bible twice, and I'm all or nothing kind of guy. So I began attending this missionary church, asked these poor missionaries all these questions that they couldn't answer. argued about Exodus 32, Israel and Oholiab creating a tabernacle, and they were like, what are you talking about? I don't think I read that passage. And eventually, I didn't realize that I had become a follower of Christ until a year later, because I kept on saying no to the idea that I was a Christian. So I kept on arguing myself out of the institutional side of faith while I was so committed to understanding Christ's death, life, death, and resurrection as the basis of everything I was doing. So I became this passionate evangelist before I knew what that meant. Mm. And then later on, when I was writing Silence and Beauty, I was doing some research, and I came to find out that, and my mother had passed away, and I was doing some reflection on her life, and then I remember her saying that, you know, when I told her that I had become a follower of Christ, that I was serving as an elder in a Presbyterian church in New York City, she said, well, I'm not surprised. And I said, what do you mean, Mom? And she said, well, you have a great uncle who is a Presbyterian evangelist in Southern Japan.
You never knew that.
Mom, you didn't tell me this. And she said, you never asked. And so when Tim Keller interviewed me to be an elder at Redeemer Presbyterian Church, she asked me, so why are you a Presbyterian? I said, I'm a Presbyterian because I was a Presbyterian before I knew I was a Presbyterian. So there you go.
Well, very nice. Well, let's explore a little bit this, see if we can find any connections between art and science in this way. Mm-hmm. So I read through your book, Art and Faith, that's sitting right here, and was looking for points of connection between art and faith and science. And I didn't really have to look very hard, for this word creation kept jumping out in like a multivalent way that I think has some really important insights that we can try to draw together here. So God created all things through Christ. We humans are created in God's image, and now we have image itself that's loaded with artistic connotations, right? We are the poema of God, the workmanship of God. You create art. Scientists investigate creation. I'm curious how you understand this term create or creation and the various ways that it's used by artists and theologians and scientists. What are the overlapping connotations, at least, that you see there?
I began the book with this theological concept of aseity, A-S-E-I-T-Y, which is a concept that theologians admit they don't even talk about today.
Like it a lot.
But they do. There's a basis, which aseity of God is basically that God is all sufficient, self-sufficient. Therefore, God doesn't need us. God doesn't need a creation. God doesn't need a church. And it's the independence of God from time and space. God exists outside of time and space, all sufficient. Now, why is that important? It's important because if that is not the case in creation, that, you know, God's act of creation was not out of need, but out of love. That changes everything. And when I think about my struggle as an artist to understand my own creation and this gift that I felt that I had, but I, again, as I say, the modernist concept of creativity and imagination cannot account for this. I began to understand that, you know, that's a reversal of how anthropology of modern times allows human beings, because human beings are the center of all things, right? So that we are the ones that creates a need for God, and therefore God needs us. That kind of thinking, you know, it's elusive. It's not maybe spelled out in every, you know, philosophical discourse, but it's behind all of the art that I can say, the motivation, the, you know, self-expression. And yet, what happens in the mystery of creation, even in agnostic, atheistic time, is that art itself expresses something gratuitous. That reflects this aseity of God more perfectly than sometimes in our preaching. So I had this hunting to do, in a way, or mystery, or at least a search toward the mystery. And so I began to think of art, and the conversation here gets very interesting, because one of the great dialogue partner was my father, who is not a Christian, and yet he believed that sciences would be impossible without Christianity, Judeo-Christian base. So he had thought through, in terms of generative language especially, how languages, you know, and speech reproduction cannot account for itself. If the data cannot account for this reality of understanding that the basis of language is this generative reality. So it kind of sits at the mystery of outside of time and space, in a sense. So anyways, to go into a conversation between art and science with my father, was this fascinating exercise in parsing out what does it mean for me as a follower of Christ to present something that is cohesive enough to someone who may not have that theistic faith, but have a basis of understanding of how limited science may be in light of this aseity of God. I can talk to my father about that. But it was hard to talk to sometimes a Christian about that.
So historically, I think the point your father was making of the necessity of this view of God and of creation as coming from a Christian worldview in a certain sense, if God created gratuitously or just out of love, as opposed to creating necessarily or there being this emanation that flows out, then we have to actually go out and look in the world to see how God may have done it. And this seems to be one of the big impulses for the development of modern science, was people who had this view of God that led to experimentation and observation instead of sitting in a dark room and thinking that I could just figure out all of reality as a necessary outcome.
And you know, Darwin, right, in his journey toward this identifying the data points where, you know, he was kind of working backwards, but his faith was dependent on this mechanistic idea, you know, Peirce's idea. He was influenced by watchmaker's theory, where, you know, you should be able to trace backwards from the data into God, right? And that to my father would have been kind of a ludicrous idea, because he said that from the get-go, you have a cohesive reality only because God has created this reality. It's the foundation of all understanding of how you rely on data to bring in, you know, improved mechanism, right? So, we would talk about Darwinian evolution, and you know, my father's understanding was not what you would expect a scientist to say about that.
Interesting.
Yeah.
You have some other reflection in your book here on making as a way of knowing, how making is the deepest integrated realm of knowing, you say, and also the ultimate understanding of the gospel is what we make and what we love. I've been thinking about this and how far we can push that to the sciences as well, wondering whether a scientific theory is comparable to an artistic creation in this respect. Because we usually say that scientists discover rather than create or invent scientific truths, right? But there's definitely an element of creativity that's involved and insight that's involved in coming up with scientific theories that explain a wide range of data. So can we say of scientists, as you have said of artists, that they're involved in making as a way of knowing?
Absolutely. Prime numbers weren't there until we discovered it, right? We invented,
There's a big philosophical debate about
it. I know, we can go into that because we won't hear, but later on. But yes, right, which is it? And that is the way that we should be asking that question, right? To debate over something that has multiple entry points and multiple ways of understanding it. But at the very least, we should agree that there's mystery to that.
Okay.
And this idea that we come into knowledge through, perhaps this certainty, rather than being humble enough to say, like my father at the end of his life, he said, we may not understand language. Where all his colleagues were saying that in 1970s, early 70s in Bell Labs, they were saying that we will be able to use the segmentalist data that we have gathered. Our computers are fast enough to create a speech reproduction system that you will not be able to tell that it's a machine. My father said, no way. It's like cutting a frog and stitching it back together and hope that it jumps again. The data is segmented. That's not how human speech works. So, going back to what we're talking about, we are, passing out the reductivist approach of gathering data and assuming that there is certainty there. That is how mechanistic universe should work. But when we leave out the mystery of the ontological mystery of how that data will even be gathered, or how the basis of what, let's say, speech is being given to us as a gift, right? That it is not just speech of information that, data points, but it is actually a song. Actually a mystery embedded in human speech where, all of us in the same room using that language and communicating to each other will generatively amplify the mystery. Now that is a different kind of conversation you have with scientists like
right.
my father.
Right.
Yeah.
Let's look a little more specifically here then between maybe your art and something like our understanding of evolution, because I think there's some really interesting touch points that come from your book in that regard as well. Colin has a few images he's going to put up on the screen here of you creating your art. For those who are listening, we'll put some links to those in the show notes. One idea here is the relationship of time to creation. You call your own work slow art. And that it fights against efficiency, which I think is a really interesting phrase. Lots of people worry about God creating through evolution because it takes so long and it appears to be inefficient. So give us a defense of creating slowly. Why is that a better way of making?
Yes, because slowness harnesses something that, you know, we assume efficiency comes with speed, but slowness actually harnesses a deeper integration of whatever the data point we have. What that means is multiple variables can come into play in building a set of data that we may not be able to account for if we don't have time stretched out. So in a sense, what we're talking about, you know, when I was at undergrad at Bucknell, one of the textbooks that I have kept is Sociobiology by Wilson's masterpiece, right? And there is a little paragraph in there which caught my attention. Now, this was before my theistic days. I didn't understand how to answer this question, but it's about altruism. How does altruism come to be in you know, studying ants and insects? And E.O. Wilson asked this question in a way that I think opened up something in me and perhaps to him as well. Because he's asking a question not about the end result, but he's asking the question about the process. He's asking a question about what happens when altruistic behavior come to surface. Is that at the end of, you know, consolidated, let's say mechanistic? Or is it because all these variables play into, in the slowness of time, something that we cannot account for? Mm. And so even that way of explaining that, you know, something that he can't explain, I begin to wonder if, because of my father's influence on me, certainly, that there is something more to sciences than, you know, just figuring out mechanistically how to fix a problem. There's a deeper questioning that we can do if we allow that, that allows for perhaps something that modern understanding of creating certainty mechanistically or using this segmentalist data cannot account for, you know, and slowness of time is one of them. And so one of my personal response to that is, as an artist, I wanted to select a method in which it took time for me to create my own paint, pulverize pigments, you know, do 100 layers before you start the paint, paper that requires certain care, so that how to even use stretch paper depending on the climate, depending on where you're doing it, will change. So all these variables will require for me to slow down. And my father will come into my studio and sit in front of my painting for literally an hour, just looking at it, beholding it. And to me, as I think about his life, that was the greatest gift that he has given me, because he knew that all good things, right, good understanding, it requires for him to be humble before whatever it is that he's beholding, whatever it is that he's trying to understand, right? This notion of standing under to understand. Don't stand over it, because that's overstanding.
This process of creating, I'm really interested in to hear you talk a little bit more about, because it seems maybe to many of the rest of us that if you need paints and you need paper, you go down to the local Michaels or the local art store to buy those instead of pulverizing the minerals yourself and creating. Yeah. Is there something in the process itself that gives you joy. And it's not just, you can probably see where I'm going here with relating to God as creating this process. Because if you do the math, Homo sapiens don't appear until 99.998% of all of natural history that we have. And we as Christians who think there's something important and special about us, you have to think, well, what's God doing the whole rest of the time? Mm-hmm. Talk to us as a someone who creates yourself through this long process. Is there something in the, you're not just saying, oh, this long process, I can't believe I have. Yeah. Is that giving you joy? Is that part of the love you spoke of earlier as well? That we can see God in that sense too?
It's connected to love, because time is not this linear progression of events. Time actually, biblically, it's Kairos time is different from Naos time, right? That Chronos or Naos, Kairos time has eternity built in to that moment. So you might be laboring for years and years to prepare something, and then all of a sudden a discovery happens where there's an explosion, an opening that it would only happen if you had spent that time preparing for that moment. But it seems like every other, notion of slow labor it's no longer slow or no longer tedious, because it becomes such an accentuated reality of seeing something new for the first time. And that to me is how I want my work to capture that sense. So I know David Brooks is coming tomorrow, but David, I asked him when he first entered my gallery in New York. I said, David, you're not going to see my painting for about 15 minutes. Would you be willing to just sit in front of it? Just like my father did, but he didn't know my father. So, and to David's credit, he did that. And at the end of 15 minutes, he said, "I cannot believe my eyes."
You mean after 15 minutes
of just staring at it? He said, "When I walked in, it was a green painting. Now I see an entire cosmos." So somatically, something opens up. Right? Is that 15 minutes? Tedious, perhaps. But we don't talk about that, right? We talk about that moment of discovery, when the whole entire cosmos opens up to you, and all of a sudden you're ushered into this portal, and portal of understanding the cosmos, and the way that we are meant to experience that fully, and being present before it. So it, the time is very different in that equation. Mm-hmm.
So there's another aspect of that long time, at least long from our standpoint, and something like most estimates are more than 99% of the species that have ever existed have gone extinct.
Right.
And we might think also of that as an inefficiency. I wonder if we might see it as something different, as something of the lavishness of creation. All of these species that got to exist that couldn't have all existed at one time. That might be one way of thinking about it. But there's no getting around the fact that evolution as a means of creation involves some suffering, involves some death. And I don't know that we are ever going to have a fully satisfactory answer to why God might create that way. But I wonder if maybe we can point to some answers that aren't completely satisfactory, but at least bring us into the space where we start to have some insights for maybe why that could be. You discuss in the book this ancient Japanese technique of kintsugi.
Yeah.
Is that how I pronounce it
correctly?
Yes, kintsugi. Nice. Tell us about this artistic technique and how it may gesture toward understanding how God may take the brokenness of this creation and make it into something even more beautiful.
Kintsugi is a venerable tea tradition that goes back to 16th century Japan and beyond, but there's a very important critical moment in Japanese history where this one tea master, Senno Rikyu, began to speak against the dictatorial persecution or oppression and warmongering that was going on in Japan. It was literally called the war period in Japanese history, Sengoku Jidai, where Rikyu came in as a tea master, created a ritual of peace. In the midst of this very conflicted political reality, he managed to carve out a tiny little tea house where he would invite the most powerful people into that tea house, and one-to-one, he would just serve tea without saying much. But in order to get into the tea house, there's a little hole called Nijiriguchi, which is set up so that any samurai coming into that tea house will have to remove their sword off, otherwise they can't enter. So it is literally a place of shalom, place of peace. And out of that tradition comes this tradition of kintsugi. Kin is gold. Tsugi means to mend. Tsugi can also means to pass on to the next generation. And it's this art of taking a broken pottery. Sometimes teaware, very important teaware, break in Japan because of many earthquakes and tsunamis. And the family of tea masters will often hold on to the fragments of an important teaware for several generations. And then they will give it to a Japan lacquer master, urushi master, to mend. But the urushi master doesn't just fix the board to make it look like it was never broken. Urushi master decides on how the fracture, depending on how the fracture is done, to accentuate the brokenness, just like this, and highlight and to make the fractures beautiful with gold. And so the end result, kintsugi bowl, is far more valuable than the original, even though the original may be very valuable. So this idea of new creation, idea of thinking about as Christians, post-resurrection appearances of Jesus, he comes not just as a human being, full human being, glorified, but he comes back as a wounded human being with nail marks. That's a remarkable reality. And so I think of kintsugi as a way of understanding new creation, post-resurrection journey that we ought to be on ourselves, where our fractures and our woundedness, our hearts broken, can become an entry point into something more beautiful, because God is the ultimate kintsugi master.
That really is beautiful. And I don't want to press this metaphor too far, but I can't imagine that people are taking their valuable tea sets and intentionally smashing them just in order to take to a kintsugi master, right? But rather this is seen as, this is something hard and tragic that has happened, but that we're able to create something beautiful out of that tragedy.
Absolutely. And you're not actually glorifying brokenness to the extent it's best to be, to Nakamura-san, the kintsugi master who co-founded Academy Kintsugi with me and my wife Hejin, says, we have enough broken things in the world. And you may think coming into a kintsugi workshop or experience that you don't have anything broken, but that's not true. We just don't know how to look for it. We have built this cultural facade, wearing masks to look perfect, look like we are whole. In fact, all of us, I don't think anybody can say today, especially after the pandemic, that we're not broken. So, but how we see that, how we tend to it and mend that is critical, right, for the future of understanding
a culture and sciences have a great role to play here, because the pieces cannot fit together if the physics doesn't work, right? If the urushi doesn't hold, so it's critical that the engineering part works in tandem with the aesthetic part. So this is a perfect example, actually, of science and art coming together. And this was done by one of our kintsugi instructors, Eva Crawford, who is an artist in Charlotte. And she brought this with her to India, where Haejin and I went, where her organization, Embers International, is literally rescuing girls out of red light districts, girls and boys, and educating them, and to them, to how their lives will be seen, you know, justice is not complete when they're just rescued. Justice is when they see themselves as beautiful. So how do we do that in education? How do we do that together, collectively, here in America? Well, that's the question of post-pandemic journey.
Yeah, that's beautiful. Well, I want to shift to talking about what you've called culture care. I think that's a really interesting phrase, which has a fruitful relationship to science and faith concerns about creation care, which, how do we care for what God has created? But now you're asking, how do we care properly for what we have created with culture? And to explore this topic a little bit, we're going to bring a couple other people into the conversation. So Colin is going to introduce our first.
Yeah, our first audience question is from Sari Martin Concepcion, who works for one of our sister organizations, Blueprint 1543.
Hello. So I'm wondering, there's sort of this perception or reputation in the public square or in our communities that science is sort of responsible for the de-enchantment of the universe and the sense of the crisis of modern people to feel like there's a lack of meaning in lived experience, and that science with its cold, hard facts is responsible for a lot of that. So I'm just wondering, if we want to bring the culture along with us in a more holistic, integrated way, what role could the arts perhaps have a role to play in holding these different domains of knowledge together and, you know, being less siloed and less guilty of this de-enchantment phenomenon? Well,
thanks for that. Artists are just as responsible for disenchanting, perhaps even more. So, first of all, creation care it requires, in a way, in my mind, cultural care, especially in America. Because if you don't have cultural care, if you don't have language to understand the divide and fragmentation that we're experiencing in culture and create a new set of vocabulary, how to talk about those fractures, like kintsugi, we end up in culture wars, not culture care. And culture war will displace what is good and beautiful and true about creation care and push it to the margins where extremists fight over funding, fight over why it's important. And we will not be able to care and steward a creation because it's basically mired in culture war realities where the culture becomes a battleground rather than a garden to tend to. So culture, to me, is an ecosystem to steward. So I do not separate, actually, between culture and nature in the same way that, you know, I think you whenever you separate and divide categorically these elements, you start to lose the conversation, you start to do the song, you do in fact make it into a mechanistic enterprise where you argue over who's right and who's wrong, and the categories become smaller and smaller. Pretty soon you're fighting over things that you never thought you would have to fight over. So I think a project of culture care is to rely on poets and rely on artists to expand the language, to in a sense sanctify imagination, so that we have a collective generative base of language to speak about the realities of what is happening, the real issues in front of us, the what I call the ground zero realities facing us today.
Colin, you have another audience question queued up for us here.
Yeah, our next question is from David Lottie. David has been a guest on the podcast before. He's associate professor of biology at Queens College, City University of New York.
Hello, and thank you for these wonderful insights. It's been an inspiring discussion. I'm interested in this analogy between creation care and culture care. In particular, when we think of creation care, God says his creation is good, and so our task is merely to recognize that, and then anything that follows from our recognition of the goodness of creation is our care. However, when we make the analogy, there is a certain variation that is introduced by humans in our cultural phenomena that is not so clear-cut. So we could talk about variation in quality or variation in beauty, but let's just talk about variation in goodness. There's a moral ambiguity about the products of human culture. And so how does that complexify culture care? And how do we make the decision as to how much to preserve or what to preserve in culture?
Yeah, thanks for that. Easy question to address. Yes, we can create beautiful paintings or create weapons of mass destruction. What is the responsibility of any creator, and how does the creator sees what we do? And in Genesis 2, we are told that in Eden, this is before the fall, Adam was asked to name the animals. And that, the way I understand a path into new creation, that was the beginning of Adam realizing what God wanted to do was to teach Adam that he was missing Eve. But really in that process, you know, Adam began this function of a human being to name things and to create categories and to begin to understand Eden as a place of making himself. That those whatever he named the animals, you know, God emphasized God's delight in what Adam named. So he didn't say, "Are you sure you want to name that giraffe?" You know, no, he said yes, right? And I talk about in the book how I saw this poster in the subway in New York City once, that Bronx Zoo has 4,000 some species. And so that's at least a 4,000 yes and one big no, you know. And so that really began this process of human beings being involved, asked by God to be involved in God's creation. And of course the fall made this much more complicated, because what we can do now is to create weapons to kill each other, and we do. So how does that naming continue after the fall, certainly continues, but, you know, we're creating Tower of Babel and Golden Calf instead of a tabernacle. So that there's always that tension in human society. But what I would say is critical here is that the naming is now even more important, because not because what we can do, but because what God has instituted through Christ and through the Spirit. The Pentecostal reality of the Spirit coming in to empower fallen human beings to speak the truth in love, that has opened up a way in which all of our naming becomes far more important. In fact, to the extent that God wants us to be a critical base for new creation. I mean, what I just said is so mind-boggling. It you would think, well, that can't be true. God is depending on us to create in order for new creation to be ushered in. So you have to think about that. But I think we started with the aseity of God, the utter independence of God. We can also talk about the incarnation of Christ as the beginning of this dependency of God. Christ was utterly dependent on creation, on Mary and Joseph, right? What does that mean? There's a huge paradox at work, simultaneously operating, which I think leads to this possibility that human beings in this new reality of new creation, in Christ, we're new creation, as Paul says. That reality is breaking out in front of us, but God waits until we make to show up. So somehow, sciences and the arts are supposed to play not only a huge role, but perhaps one of the ways that we can understand both the independence of God and dependence of God and move into the interdependence of new creation is by understanding how we come together, right? Scientists and artists and philosophers and educators, all of us need to come together to understand how this relationship, this mystery, can bear itself in the world full of fractures, and yet that is what's going to mend and create something new. And God is actually telling us, I am going to wait until you figure this out, until you come together and you create something for the glory of my name, to name that which is already broken, we know that, is maybe shattered beyond description, but I have given you all that you need to accomplish something, and then I'm going to use that in order to bring in the new creation. Mm. Nice.
I have one more topic on my outline. The last topic is appropriately about the last things. You have a really beautiful section in your book on eschatology and draw heavily from the eschatology of our mutual friend Tom Wright in your work. And you suggest that art can prepare us. You've touched on some of this already. Let me just see if I can pull it out one more time here. You've suggested that art can prepare us for God's new world by creating beauty. So I'm interested to hear you talk a little bit more about the actual creation of beauty as a way of preparing us for God's new kingdom. And then to reflect a little bit on the role of science in this, which you've pointed to some, but is there an analogous role for science, perhaps is discovering truth a way also of anticipating the new kingdom where all things will be made clear to us?
Yeah, naming is part of scientific discovery, and then, you know, understanding how it fits into the whole. So part of the understanding of new creation, you know, I raised this example in the book. I was listening to my friend Andy Crouch talk about the Eucharist. And he was talking about how, you know, it's like Malcolm Gladwell's 10,000 hours of expertise. It actually is very difficult to make good wine. And it's actually pretty difficult to make good bread for those of us who tried during the pandemic.
I'm trying.
Yeah, it takes a while for you to figure out how to bake even a simple bread. Now, I was listening to him talk about this in terms of, you know, practice of making something good, how long it takes. And I just had this revelation, like, oh my goodness, that's the theology of making, because God waited until we learned to make wine. We learned to make bread to show up. That's the table. That's the most important presentation. You know, God, as Tom Wright says, didn't give us a lecture. God just gave us a meal. But in order for meal to happen, we have to spend 10,000 hours of failure of trying to make good wine and good bread. And that's, I think, how the new creation works. If we go to 7-Eleven and buy it, I guess we could, but, you know, that's not what I don't think is the intended meaning of how God created in us the slow reality, the fabric of the growth of how our hands are built to make something beautiful and good tasting in order for us to enjoy that. That is fundamental to God's presence in our world. And more importantly, new creation doesn't happen until we do that. So that tells me, at least as an artist thinking about this, that what I do matters in the studio, that the invisible hard work of preparing so that that one line can go on a silk well. And by the way, it's not just my labor, but labor of these artisans in Japan who created this ink stick that took generations of knowledge, 100 years really, of creating this one stick, you know, and then curing it and waiting until it's just right. That's part of this too. So combined cultural reality is full of these signposts of the new creation that, you know, we need to pay more attention to in the church, certainly. And we need to understand that anything good that's worth waking up to and being excited about takes time, sometimes generations, to cultivate. And so this understanding of what I do in the studio matters. That single line can lead to, even though I am unable to perhaps finish that painting, God is going to complete not just that painting, but is going to create a new world out of that. That whole notion is essentially why we cannot be preaching just about redemption and restoration of us from, you know, entering into God's domain through Christ's sacrifice. And we forget that the reason why we're here, because we have been redeemed, is to partake in this adventure, partake in this journey into new creation, that God is actually wanting us, waiting for us, to draw that single line so that God can open up a whole universe through that line.
That last line that you gave there, I think, is really important, because too often I think people, when they sometimes hear this eschatology mm-hmm. of Tom Wright, they're upon the first hearing, they might think that we ourselves are somehow going to bring about this new created right. order, right. all of our own. But what you're just said there is that what we do matters.
Yeah.
It's not as though God is going to create this new creation ex nihilo right. out of nothingness, but rather in the same way of Kintsugi, right. of taking what we have done and transforming it mm-hmm. into this new creation. So yeah. it's not as though we can do this all on our own either, right?
Totally. I mean, what we can do is very little. We're naming the animals. God made the animals. We're just naming. But somehow the whole thing is inverted. The journey is inverted. When Christ became a babe in the manger, God would rather risk everything and be completely dependent on our creation to exist. That's like so far beyond what, like, our daily understanding of what God did, right? But that's the entry point into something so beyond the scope of understanding. Even the best minds will not be able to understand this. So my father was right. There is mystery of creation that we're just tapping into. When you study language, just by studying language, you understand that you are humbled by what you observe there. And at the end of his life, he was even more humble about the capacity of human beings to be able to understand human speech. And to me, that leads me to understand that, yes, I'm a follower of Christ, and I understand this redemptive journey that I have been fortunate to be on, but that's just the beginning of the mystery of what I will discover. And being able to bring that into the darkest places of the world, like what my wife is trying to do in India, it doesn't, you know, everything is upside down. You see the beauty and joy in these children that doesn't make sense mm-hmm. in our understanding, our conception of what justice is. And that kind of, for me, is a way that entire project, human project, but how the sciences should operate. We should be looking for upside down things. And we should be just as, you know, innovative in observing and creating. And we should have artists join that process, because they're the ones who may have observations that we need to discover something new. So this understanding, it has to be done communally. We need to journey together, and then somehow God is going to use that single line to open up a new portal.
Mm-hmm. Thanks. Well, I think we're out of time. There are several more avenues I would love to walk down and hear you talk about, but we will leave it there for now. And I ask our audience to join me in thanking you for your work and for your art and for being with us here today.
Language of God is produced by BioLogos. It has been funded in part by the John Templeton Foundation, the Fetzer Institute, and by individual donors who contribute to BioLogos. Language of God is produced and mixed by Colin Hugerwerf. That's me. Nate Mulder is our assistant producer, and our theme song is by Breakmaster Cylinder. BioLogos offices are located in Grand Rapids, Michigan, in the Grand River watershed. If you have questions or want to join in a conversation about this episode, find a link in the show notes for the BioLogos Forum, or visit our website, biologos.org, where you'll find articles, videos, and other resources on faith and science. Thanks for listening.